It's often been said that death is the muse of philosophy. And if that is so, it means that death was a kind of energizer for philosophical thinking. Philosophers have thought about the question of death long before the phenomenon of man-made mass death ever appeared.
A philosopher talks about contemporary life and death, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Edith Wishegrod teaches philosophy at Queens College of the City University of New York. She is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Professor Wishegrod was educated at Hunter College and Columbia University. She is the author of two books on ethical metaphysics and the phenomenon of death. Professor Wishegrod, it's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center, and I'm very grateful to you for coming down to talk about your work here at the Center for Soundings, the Center's radio program. You're a philosopher. You make your living teaching philosophy and writing about philosophy. You are writing about the phenomenon of mass death. What does that phrase mean?
Well, to me, Wayne, it means something very specific. It means a unique phenomenon of the 20th century in which millions and millions of people have been killed, and a phenomenon that's different from anything that happened before. I see mass death as connected with human action. That is, I mean by the phenomenon of mass death, man-made mass death, something that people do to other people.
In other words, Professor Wishegrod, you distinguish between historical tragedy, the kind of thing that occurred in the Middle Ages with the Black Death, with the plague, and the kind of thing that occurred in Nazi Germany in the middle of this century.
I think it's very important to draw a line between natural calamity, either in the form of disease or in the form of earthquake or famine that comes about without the intervention of human agency, and man-made mass death.
Professor Wishegrod, what brought you to a philosophical study of a question like mass death?
You know, Wayne, there was a great deal of talk right after World War II of philosophers about problems of existence. In fact, there was a name given to philosophers who used that sort of language. They were called existentialists. And after having read a good deal of existential philosophy, it seemed to me that while they talked about death, they never mentioned the question of mass death.
Professor Wishegrod, death has always been on people's minds to one extent or another. Why is it that you view this phenomenon of mass death as a contemporary problem?
Well, it's true that war and man-made mass death has always been with us. The difference now is scale and quantity. That is, we have the capacity to wipe out enormous numbers of persons, and this is different from what had been true of war in the past. I think the reason for this is that two features of modern life have come together. The one is bureaucracy, and the other is technology. It's easy enough to understand why technology is involved. Bigger and better weapons, bigger and better ways to kill people will do the job more efficiently. But one still thinks, isn't it possible for people to restrain themselves and not use the technologies that have been developed? Here, I think the matter of bureaucracy is important.
You mean people have sort of surrendered themselves to bureaucracies which make these decisions?
Yes. Bureaucracy has the capacity to do two things. On the one hand, bureaucracies tend, when they are efficient, to be able to accumulate information about vast numbers of people. And secondly, they can use the information that they have without placing on any one person too large a share of the blame. So what bureaucracy does is it deputizes responsibility. It gives away chunks of responsibility to very many different people.
How do we get away around? Is there a way around this problem?
Well, it's awfully hard to find a way around it. But one beginning is to realize that bureaucracy and technology are in a kind of conspiracy. They go together. And that realization may, if it doesn't do away with bureaucracy, which seems to me terribly unlikely, change its character so that people become responsible for the chunks of the assignments that have been given to them. That is, they become responsible for their actions as part of the larger set of activities in any given context.
Well, why would mass death be of interest to philosophers? Don't philosophers try to figure out what life is about?
Well, that's a very good question, Wayne. Philosophers do indeed try to figure out what life is about. But if you can't ask a question about the meaning of life without thinking also about the meaning of death, then philosophers have to think about death when they think about life.
Why does it occur? Is that what you're trying to figure out?
Well, maybe I ought to start by saying some things about the way that philosophers have looked at death in the past. It's often been said that death is the muse of philosophy. And if that is so, it means that death was a kind of energizer for philosophical thinking. Philosophers have thought about the question of death long before the phenomenon of man-made mass death ever appeared. So if you're a philosopher reading the history of philosophy, you're going to think about death without necessarily placing it in a contemporary context. And philosophers have looked at the question of death in a variety of different ways.
And what are they?
For instance, Wayne, if you go all the way back to Plato, who was probably the most important philosopher in the history of Western thought, Plato saw death as the separation of the body from the soul. It was assumed that the body would decay, but that the soul was immortal and would live on. And that view of death dominated our thinking about death for a very long time, even though it's also true that in the ancient world there were other ways of thinking about death.
But that was the one that seemed to dominate.
But that was the one that seemed to dominate and that held up and still holds for a great many people. It passed into Christian tradition and it was modified, but still the idea is that when you die, the body decays, but something that really represents you will hang on.
Continues on.
Now, that faith has, to some extent, been destroyed, not only in our own thinking about death, but even in the ancient world, there were already questions raised about this view. There were people who said, when I die, maybe it just might be that no part of me will remain at all, that all I really am is my body. And an ancient philosopher, his name was Epicurus, said, when I am, death is not, and when death is, I am not. And so it was already a question for the ancients. Is it possible that when I die. That is the end.
Well, how has that evolved? I mean, how do philosophers look at the question of death today?
Well,
I mean, that's still pretty much a popular concept.
It's a concept that also has survived for many people. There are those who think that when they die, there is nothing else. That's it. It's the end. It's a concept that has a good deal of currency today. There were other conceptions of death. It sounds as if those would be the two alternatives, but there are other conceptions of death. And I think the third one that I want to mention is probably could be seen as the contemporary view. In other words, I can't think of any ancient philosopher who would have held the view that I'm going to mention in the same way. And that is that death is the touchstone that enables us to judge our lives. You can find that view expressed beautifully in a story written by the Russian writer Leo Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Illich. In that story, Ivan Illich leads a kind of ordinary life until he gets terribly ill and realizes that he's going to die. And then he has to look back at his life in the light of his impending death and see whether he would have lived it in the same way had he thought about death all the way along. Would he have made the same choices? Would he have had the job he had? Would he have married the wife he did, and so on?
So although the fact of death is unalterable, there's nothing that anybody can do about it, it takes on a meaning for us in the sense that it gives us a yardstick against which to judge whether how we're living is good or bad.
Yes, Wayne, I think that's exactly right.
Well, how does that
death
bear?
Death is the yardstick by means of which we judge our lives.
How does that bear on this question that you're looking at of mass death?
Well, in the case of mass death, we have to ask ourselves, is it possible, even if we think about our individual deaths, is it possible to imagine our lives as having any meaning if the totality of people, the world, everything that we know and consider important and precious could be wiped out? Does that make a difference? And my answer would be that the scale, quantity, makes all the difference. In our ordinary way of looking at death, we can still imagine ways in which we would be immortal. We could live on through our children, through our works, all kinds of possibilities in terms of having our own personalities continue. But the phenomenon of mass death, as it has occurred in the 20th century, man-made mass death, has changed all of that.
What, for instance, are you looking at? I assume that you're talking about the Nazi Holocaust. Would you also be looking at things like what occurred in Guyana with Jim Jones, that sort of thing?
Well, I'm especially interested in phenomena that are violent in their character and massive in their scope. So I am interested in war as it has been conducted in the 20th century. I'm interested in the Holocaust. I'm also interested in man-made famine, in scorched earth, in all those techniques which have made possible the elimination of millions and millions of people.
Professor Wishegrad, these are interesting examples that you've mentioned, the Guyana thing and the Nazi Holocaust. And I don't mean to be flippant when I ask you, so what? What can you prove? What conclusion can you draw from this? Is it something that's going to give us a greater reservoir of hope or knowledge about living now?
Well, it seems to me that even if it can't provide us with a reservoir of hope, and it would be hard to see how that could be the case, Still, it would give us a certain kind of knowledge that we didn't have to have before. We would recognize the phenomenon. At least we would have it in place in our minds. And a second thing that I think is important for us is to realize that even when we aren't consciously thinking about it, even when it's really at the far corner of our minds, that the existence of this phenomenon conditions the way we look at things. For instance, I would think that some of this pleasure-seeking of the 20th century comes from the sense we have that, after all, not only I myself might come to an end, but the whole world might come to an end. So maybe living for the present, living in the now, is a way of hiding from this very disturbing and distressing fact. That's only one possible response. But I think that the knowledge of the existence of man-made mass death does infiltrate the way we think about even ordinary things, even if we aren't fully conscious of the way that it functions.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Edith Wishegrod is a professor of philosophy at Queens College of the City University of New York. She is also a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Professor Wishegrod's discussion for Soundings deals with a book she's writing about the phenomenon of mass death in the 20th century. Professor Wishegrod, it's been said that Europeans look upon life and experience a little bit more jadedly than Americans do. They have a little bit more jaundiced view of life. They've been through wars on their own home turf that America has never really experienced. Is there a difference between, is that true, particularly in terms of this topic that you're looking at, the phenomenon of mass death from a philosophical standpoint?
Well, Wayne, I think that the answer is yes, but a qualified yes. I think it probably was true for the Europe between World War I and World War II, and for the generation that experienced World War II in Europe. But the new younger European seems to me to be very much in the situation of the young American. While it's true that signs of devastation are still seen in Europe, they're really traces. You don't see the kind of thing that was evident right after the war. So it seems to me that Europeans were for a time perhaps wiser, or one might put it differently, perhaps more cynical than Americans, but I think that's now evened out. I think the Vietnam War perhaps has made Americans terribly conscious of the possibilities of man-made mass death in a way that was not true before.
So we're closing the gap.
In fact, we've probably already closed it, Wayne. Of course, it is true that older Europeans have a memory of the war and certainly would not like to see it happen again. But I think by now the edges of that have rubbed off.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that most societies have relatively short memories about mass tragedies when lots of people die? My question is, how do you communicate a sense of importance or a sense of urgency about this problem of mass death or the issue of mass death to people who really don't want to look at it? You know, they're interested in living. They really don't want to worry about dying themselves or as a society.
Well, I'm not interested in making people unhappy or uncomfortable with their everyday lives. I don't think that one wants to have mass death on one's mind all the time. But I do think that we have to register in a very sensitive way the changes in our attitudes that have already occurred, even when we're not in the process of thinking about man-made mass death. So it's not that I have an agenda or think that it's good to raise consciousness on the matter, but only to say that changes already have taken place. We have new screens or new grids through which we look at things, and these grids make the map of our everyday experience look quite different.
Professor Wishegrad, you are looking at the phenomenon of mass death from a philosophical standpoint, but it seems to me that it also has a clear political implication. You might be accused of being a peacenik because you're looking at this problem. What is the politics of mass death?
Well, from my point of view, it doesn't necessarily entail any given political opinions. Certainly, I can't imagine any sane person approving of man-made mass death, but I don't think that it follows from the fact that one doesn't like it that any given set of policies, such as the reduction of armaments, follows. It may be that it would be a good idea to reduce armaments, but I think it could be argued with equal conviction that the increase of armaments would lessen the danger of man-made mass death. So I don't think attention to the phenomenon and examination of it necessarily leads to any one set of political entailments.
Professor Wishegrad, could you give me a specific example of one of the phenomena of mass death that you were looking at, and whatever conclusions or tentative conclusions might be implicit in what you've written?
Well, I suppose the phenomenon that people think about first would be the concentration camp experience. What I try to do is to show that within the context of what I call a death world, there grows up a new language and a new logic. By a new language, I mean that everything that people say in that context carries with it not only its own meaning, but also the additional meaning of death. Let me give you an example. Supposing somebody offered me dinner in that context.
You mean in a concentration camp?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Usually when we think about eating, we think of pleasure, we think of how much we enjoy it. We think of it also as a necessity. Perhaps we might even think of it as a way to enjoy our friends, to share food. But the meaning of food in that setting carries with it, in addition to all the meanings that I've mentioned, also the meaning of death. Death is a kind of constant, overwhelming presence in that context. So the language of that situation is different from our ordinary language.
You mean, you don't mean the words themselves, but the meaning of
what's
been
said,
the exchanges.
That's right. It's not that the words that were used were different, although it is true that studies showed that fewer words are used because there are fewer objects. The world is not as rich or as full of things as our own world. But that's not what I mean. I mean that the same words are used, but tacked on to them, there are these extra meanings.
I'd like to ask you about what happened in Guyana with Jim Jones. What does that teach? There's been an enormous amount written about Jones and his people, and
well, I think it points up something that may be common to a number of situations in which people go to their deaths without asking too many questions, when there is a structured environment that seems to lead to the eventual annihilation of a very large number of persons, the tendency to resist seems to be very limited. And that, I think, is shared by Guyana, by the concentration camps, and also in the Russian Russian and Chinese slave labor camps.
Well, what gives rise to that mentality, that giving of oneself over?
The first step seems to be a loss of personal identity. In the concentration camps, of course, people were numbered. They no longer had their names, and one technique of depersonalization was to stamp a number on a person's arm, a tattoo. Of course, nothing so radical happened in Guyana, and I think the circumstances were very different, and they have to be taken into account. Still, when a great deal of energy and is invested in a leader and a great deal of confidence is had in a leader, the individual identity of the follower tends to be eroded, and you have that depersonalization that leads to an eventual submission to a system, even if it means your own death and the death of your loved ones.
So it's an emotional deception. It isn't simply intellectual, not at the level of outward knowledge of facts and circumstances.
Well, Wayne, sometimes it's both. It seems to be the case that the people in Guyana were not told all the facts about, for instance, the physical condition of their leader. But it's also the case that they were emotionally deceived, that they were made to, it's hard to speak about emotional deception, but let's put it a little bit differently. Their emotions were aroused in a way that was manipulative.
Professor Wishegrad, what is it that people who are alive now need to know about this question of mass death that you are looking at? Is there some benefit here that society should be aware of?
Well, Wayne, if we consider knowledge a benefit, then it's better to know than not to know. And since this is a phenomenon that has totally changed the character of contemporary existence, it's hard not to face it. And it seems that if we can create a structured body of knowledge which both attempts to accumulate historical information on the one hand and interpretations of a philosophical sort on the other, we at least can say that we have faced up to our contemporary experience. And while I don't mean to sound too optimistic a note, this is not to say, and I made this point before, Wayne, that any special set of political policies follows from what I've said. But it is to say that it's a first step in making us aware of an extremely important process that has affected contemporary existence.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me for Soundings, the Center's radio program. This week, my guest is a philosopher and writer who will discuss some connections between science and philosophy in the modern world. Please join me this week for Soundings.